This is the Inland Journal from Spokane Public Radio. I'm Doug Nadvornik. The 6th Legislative District in Spokane will have some changes in its representation next year. It starts in the Senate, where Republican Michael Baumgartner is vacating his seat. Republican Representative Jeff Holey wants to replace him. That means Holey is also vacating his seat. Today, we'll hear from the two candidates who want to replace Holey in the State House, Republican Jenny Graham and Democrat Dave Wilson. Jenny Graham says her journey to this campaign began years ago.
The process started when I made a cold call one day because I had questions about my sister's murder. She was murdered by the Green River serial killer. And when I gained access to her death investigation files, I started to recognize that there was evidence there that I didn't know existed.
Graham says her brother was also murdered. So she began to look for information about the investigations. All three siblings, she said, were abused. As a result of her research, she was convinced about the need to change state law as it related to finding justice for victimized children.
The old law stated that a child had to report abuse, and this was the same for child pornography as well. They had to report the incident within a year of it happening. And the problem with that is, in most of the time in those instances, children are not like adults. They don't have the life experience with trauma to know how to navigate that.
Graham says 2 years of working with state officials and legislators from both parties paid off in 2013.
Now every survivor has until their 30th birthday to report the abuse. And if there is evidence that's available, because these cases are so hard to try, if that evidence is there, then they have an opportunity to have their case heard in court.
She says the change in state law came too late to benefit her and her siblings, but she says abuse survivors who worked on the bill are happy it will apply to the current and future generations. Graham says she's also dedicated to making schools safer places for teachers and children.
One teacher told me that she locked her door because she was the first point of entry, and she was afraid. She got in trouble for locking her door. And I think that that's something that we can change.
She supports having security cameras in schools and putting alarms on locked doors.
I am not a huge fan of guns being in the schools with teachers. I don't have any idea what their training is. And who knows, if there were a situation, now the teachers are put in the place of trying to distinguish themselves between being a good guy or a bad guy. I would really rather work on getting that security in the schools to prevent that to begin with.
Jenny Graham's opponent is Dave Wilson. He owned and operated Interface Computer School in Spokane for 30 years before selling it 6 years ago. Now he's an education and business consultant. Wilson ran twice as an independent candidate for Washington's 5th Congressional District, in 2014 and 2016, losing in the primary both years. Now he has shifted his focus to the legislature.
I believe in good government. I believe government has an important role to play in our economy and in our society. And it's never going to be run like a business. It's not the same thing, but it plays an important role. And it just really bewilders me when I hear people in office or candidates talk about dismantling the government. Is it excessive in some points? Sure. Do we have to tear the whole thing down? No. Do we need to tweak it? Sure. You know, I look at my job as a legislator is to make sure the rules are fair, make sure the regulations are fair, and when they're not fair, listen to constituents, help them if they need help. That's my job.
Wilson says government's role is to create a civil society and create a structure by which everyone agrees to abide.
You know, the example I like to use when I'm in a room, I'll ask people, raise your hand if you drove here today. And almost every hand goes up, and then I'll say, all right, how many of you stopped at red lights on your way here? And, of course, that gets a laugh, but the point I'm making is we need those kinds of rules to function.
Wilson says he's interested in working on the state's tax structure. The high sales tax, he says, puts a greater burden proportionally on low-income people. But any changes in the tax structure, he says, must be developed and agreed upon in a bipartisan fashion. He says he's also interested in working on developing solutions to the state's mental health problems to emphasize early treatment and prevention.
if you think about it, it's not just a social issue. It's also a public safety issue, and it's also an economic issue. And there's enough body of evidence and research out there that shows that if people get mental health help early on, especially, they can be very productive citizens.
Democrat Dave Wilson won a four-way primary in August, winning about 40% of the vote. Republican Jenny Graham won 33%. You can read or hear our stories and our full interviews with all of the candidates on our website at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Click on the Regional News tab and then on the 2018 election link. Idaho voters have an interesting choice when they choose between the two candidates for governor. There's Democrat Paulette Jordan, who hopes to become the first woman and the first Native American to run the government of the state of Idaho. And there's Republican Brad Little, who is the state's lieutenant governor and a traditional conservative in a traditionally conservative state. We have reports on both. First, James Dawson introduces us to Brad Little.
It's August during election season. Where else would a politician be other than trying to shake as many hands as possible at the Western Idaho Fair?
Do you live here now?
Yeah, we do.
Are you retired or are you working?
Nearly everyone who stops to talk to Brad Little seems to be a recent California transplant, including Gail Anderson.
Hey, sir, how are you?
She sidles up to Little with a grandkid in tow.
This is the next governor of Idaho. Can you say hello?
Little is dressed in a button-up shirt, jeans, and well-worn cowboy boots. Anderson is impressed.
You know what I like about him immediately is the fact that he reminds me of my dad, an old rancher kind of guy from old school, approachable.
Anderson's quick impression sounds familiar to Jasper Lacalzi. He chairs the Department of Political Economy at College of Idaho and says that's how a lot of people see Little.
He comes out of central casting. He's third generation rancher. He wears the cowboy hat. He has the perfect family and the children and the grandchildren and such.
He says that image might stick in people's heads, but
I don't think they really know him. I think they've heard his name, they've seen him, but I think he's a hard person to get to know.
Little is 64. He was born in Emmett, Idaho, to a ranching dynasty. His grandfather emigrated here from Scotland more than a century ago. He was known as the Sheep King because he built up one of the largest sheep herds in the U.S. The family eventually sold the flock and have raised cattle ever since. Brad Little says when he was growing up, he never thought of doing anything else. In fact, he's been a rancher for most of his life.
That's what I knew. That's who my friends were. That's who I operated with.
But the family was involved in another business, politics. Little's dad, David, was a state senator, and in 2001, Little officially entered the second family business to become a state senator himself. He was elected into a leadership position almost immediately. State Senator Sean Keogh served with him for years. She says he's not your typical, charismatic, larger-than-life leader like Idaho's current governor, Butch Otter.
He's not as outgoing as Butch is. But that doesn't mean that he doesn't want to know you. He does. I think it's just a little harder for him.
It's a stark contrast to Governor Otter, who famously entered and won a Mr. Tight Jeans contest when he was lieutenant governor. Little can be shy, according to his colleagues, someone who doesn't like to be the center of attention, someone who's more comfortable talking policy than his personal life. Like Otter, Little does have his critics in his own party, though. He's been called a rhino, Republican in name only. Wayne Hoffman runs a conservative think tank called the Idaho Freedom Foundation.
I wouldn't call Brad a liberal, but I also wouldn't define him as a staunch conservative.
Hoffman faulted the then state senator for votes he cast to raise taxes, but he also gave Little a thumbs up for other votes he took to cut spending. And Hoffman says he's keeping an open mind on what Little could accomplish in office.
Brad has an opportunity to chart his own course. I would hate to predefine what that course will be.
On the campaign trail, Little has talked a lot about cutting taxes and reinvesting in Idaho's education system. The goal, he says, is to keep younger Idahoans from moving out of state, and he wants to meet that goal in partnership with the legislature.
I don't want to beat my chest about some I want to say, there's the goal, you know, more or less, let's get there. How can I work with you to get there?
A Democrat winning the governor's seat in Idaho may be about as rare as drawing a bighorn sheep hunting tag, but that doesn't leave Little complacent. His opponent, Paulette Jordan, has energized voters in ways not seen for decades, and he's taking her campaign seriously. I'm James Dawson.
And now let's meet Little's Democratic opponent, Paulette Jordan. Reporter Amanda Peacher has this profile.
When Paulette Jordan takes to the microphone at a recent house party, she starts telling a story.
When I was a kid growing up with my grandparents, I would often wake up before the sun rose, and I would always see my grandfather kind of on a ledge like this. And he would
It's a personal and intimate approach. It comes naturally to Jordan.
Overlooking our farmland.
The small backyard crowd leans in and listens carefully. Jordan is a 38-year-old mom and leader within the Coeur d'Alene tribe. She served in the state legislature before announcing her historic bid for governor. She says she wants to represent underheard voices in the state.
Everyone all across the board, they need to have a seat at the table.
Jordan supports a bunch of issues favored by liberals and Democrats in Idaho. Medicaid expansion, more funding for education, universal health care. But it's her general persona that seems to be exciting young voters, women, and minorities.
We need leadership that is determined and destined to do right by the people. We're just ready. It's well overdue for true representation of the people to be leading in the state office.
Notice how Jordan talks in terms of we and the people. Jasper Lacalzi is a political scientist with the College of Idaho. He says that's her way of captivating audiences.
When she says we, everybody can say, yeah, that's me too.
Still, Lacalzi doesn't see a lot of specificity in Jordan's policy proposals.
She's kind of a empty vessel for people.
Not in a bad way, he says. People can project what they want to see.
For some people, she's the progressive Bernie type, whereas others, she's the woman who's running, and they identify with that. With others, she's the minority.
She's the most amazing person I know.
That's Troy Hank Palmer. He went to high school with Jordan and is now volunteering for her campaign. He says as a teenager, Jordan was fierce at basketball, serious about school, and a good listener.
Instead of going out and doing fun stuff with some of us, you know, she would actually be with her elders. And she would be talking with them, learning from them, and always choose that. And so I think that's part of why she's such a wise soul.
A wise soul who, according to her supporters, really listens. At one gathering at a rural ranch, that was on display. A voter approached Jordan to bend her ear about his passion, fracking.
And you heard from me a bunch of times on oil and gas because I was writing to everybody in the legislature constantly.
This guy talks for about 10 minutes. There's a line of other people eager to meet Jordan, but she doesn't brush him off. She listens intently.
Thanks for helping us out, though, either
way. Glad to. And appreciate
we'll talk
you coming
more, so we'll follow
Please
up.
Do. Please.
This willingness to take her time with supporters has led to some criticism. Namely, she's chronically late. But Jordan has an answer for that.
My grandparents raised me. The very best way to be respectful is why I take the time to listen to every single constituent at every single one of these events. So yeah, we're going to be late because there's going to be over 100 to 200 to 300 people at every event.
Tardiness isn't the only criticism she's dealing with. Her campaign's decision to ask staffs to sign non-disclosure agreements became a huge controversy recently. At the same time, there were some staff resignations, and soon after that, the Idaho Statesman reported that her campaign had questionable links to a tribal super PAC. Mark Johnson is a former aide for Idaho's last Democratic governor, Cecil Andrus.
All of that just makes for distractions that I think really dilute the focus and have unfortunately contributed to an image, whether it's real or not, contributed to an image of turmoil and, frankly, incompetence in the campaign.
Not fair, says Jordan. She sees another reason for all the criticism.
You tend to get the hard brunt of everything because you're a woman, and especially when you're the first, or when you're of color, or when you're from rural, or when you're this or that. So.
She says she's ignoring the negativity and focusing on meeting voters one person at a time. But even if she shakes hands with every single Democrat in Idaho, a Jordan victory would be tough. Even, says Jasper Lacalzi, in a year where national Democrats hope to see a blue wave of elected officials.
But that blue wave, it crashes at the red shore of Idaho, and that's where it ends.
I'm Amanda Peacher.
Today, members of the Westboro Baptist Church, based in Kansas, plan to picket near Gonzaga University. The church is known for its protests around the nation, picketing funerals of military members who were killed overseas, among other things. According to a letter from President Thane McCullough to the Gonzaga campus community this week, the group planned to target people who were part of Spokane's LGBTQ community and people in military service. In the letter, McCullough says members of the group are not allowed to picket on campus or on private property owned by the university. The Westboro Church has been condemned by many segments of American society, and there's disagreement about how to react to its protests. Some human rights activists say the best way to combat them is to ignore them, that publicity is what they desire. Christine Hoover from Gonzaga's Institute for Hate Studies doesn't advocate that approach, nor does she support actively confronting Westboro members.
One of their goals is to engage people in ways that might result in litigation. And then that litigation, in turn, provides revenue for the Westboro Baptist Church. And that's, historically speaking, what's been documented. And so we really are playing into somebody else's agenda instead of writing our own agenda. Fundamentally, I think it's important to stand for what it is that you believe in, so that you are a part of moving the agenda forward. At the same time, the Westboro Baptist Church has an agenda that is very provocative. If you look at the history of how they engage with the community, their signage, their language, their philosophies can be, and rightly so, very, very angering. And when people are provoked, sometimes we don't respond the way that we would choose to respond if we weren't in that provoked stage.
In his letter, McCullough asked Gonzaga employees and students to wear university-themed clothing today and announced the university would hold an interfaith vigil for peace on campus during the lunch hour. He urged those who do confront Westboro members to do so peacefully and to follow the orders of campus security and police officers. Coincidentally, or maybe not, the Gonzaga Institute for Hate Studies is marking its 20th anniversary tomorrow with an event that looks back on the organization's work. We'll have more on that in a minute. Christine Hoover says the Westboro Baptist Church visit allows the Spokane community to make a statement about its values.
I think fundamentally silence is complacency, and so we cannot be silent. I don't think that ignoring is the answer, but I think how do we document what's happening here so that we know what's going on? We're not going into this blindly. And at the same time, how do we create the messaging that we think matters? There are lots of groups that are doing great work. I'll just give, for example, Life After Hate. And so with their approach on social media, anytime a hate message is retweeted, their organization, their nonprofit, receives additional funding. And so it's a little bit like a lemons to lemonade strategy that the Kootenai County Task Force has used here in our community. When there was going to be a march in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho with the Aryan Nations, the longer the Aryan Nations marched, the more money that was raised for educational purposes in the community.
The Gonzaga Institute for Hate Studies event will begin at 6:30 Friday night. Nadine Strossen, the former president of the American Civil Liberties Union, will speak via teleconference from Washington, D.C., with a panel discussion scheduled after that. The event will be held in the Hemmingson Center Ballroom on campus. In Kellogg, Idaho, the construction season is wrapping up on a big project whose goal is to greatly reduce the amount of pollution that makes its way into the South Fork of the Coeur d'Alene River. Rod Zion is overseeing the project for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. He says it has three parts. First, crews will add capacity so that huge earthen berm you see from Interstate 90 as you drive near Kellogg can become even bigger. Second, they're building an underground wall that will run along the freeway. And third, they're adding new technology to a water treatment plant that's 45 years old and way overdue for an update.
This treatment plant right now is treating mine water that comes from the Bunker Hill mine, roughly 800 to 1700 gallons per minute a day, and it's been perpetually treating that since I believe about 1974. So the treatment plant itself is kind of a older technology and the capacity somewhat limited, and so there's, you know, interest in just upgrading the plant to change to what's called a high density sludge system. and to add a filtration system, and also to increase the capacity. Because one of the other components, right now, as I said, this treatment plant is only treating mine water, but over here in the distance, you see this big mound. That's about a 270-acre impoundment of mine tailings. And back in 2000, EPA developed a project to put a cap system on that because the surface waters and snow melt and everything were percolating into the tailings and taking contamination out to the Coeur d'Alene River. And so that cap system we called basically phase one, putting a roof on the impoundment. And then over the years, they monitored that to see how well that was performing, how well it was reducing the contaminant levels going into the South Fork of the Coeur d'Alene River. And EPA, the studies showed that there was still some releases going into the river, not necessarily from the tailings body itself, but from the contamination that had migrated down into the lower levels and the groundwater was picking that up. So as part of this project, EPA decided that they wanted to collect that groundwater that's now currently flowing under the central impoundment area and into the South Fork of the Coeur d'Alene. And there's two steps to doing that. And the first one is to capture the groundwater with a series of extraction well pumps. There will be 12 extraction pumps that go along Interstate I-90 east to west. The second part of that is a cutoff wall, basically an underground dam to retain the water so the extraction wells can capture it. And it's essentially an underground clay wall, for lack of a better term. But it's bentonite, which is a form of clay that's mixed with screened materials, and about 25, 35 feet deep, and total of about 7,800 linear feet. And goes all the way from the east end of the central impoundment area towards Smelterville and forms a hook around what we call the former slag pile area. So once that's constructed, the groundwater extraction wells will convey that collected groundwater through a new pipeline system that we're building and send it to the treatment plant for treatment along with the mine water.
It's a pretty big, sophisticated system, isn't
it? It is. Kind of like three little independent projects that, you know, kind of all have to come together. And it's a fairly complex project. On top of those components, the sludge that's generated from the treatment is currently stored in an impoundment up on top of the central impoundment area. During project development, the study showed we're going to reach the capacity of that impoundment. So we developed part of the scope is to build a new sludge impoundment, which is currently under construction. It's 110,000 cubic yard, triple cell geomembrane line impoundment. So yeah, a lot of independent pieces of work that all come together to treat this water. The benefits really are, the continued cleanup of the mine water, so we're not discharging, into contamination into Bunker Creek, and then reduced, mitigating the central impoundment as a contaminant loader into the South Fork of the Coeur d'Alene River. So it's, basically it's benefiting from here all the way down to Lake Coeur d'Alene and beyond.
Rod Zion is a project engineer for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which is in the middle of this big project in Kellogg. Work will soon stop as the weather worsens and pick up again next spring. The new treatment plant is scheduled to begin operating in 2020. Inland Journal is Spokane Public Radio's weekly public affairs program. We air it every Thursday at noon on KPBX and Thursday at 3 p.m. on KSFC. You can hear the full program or individual stories online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thank you for listening and for your financial support. I'm Doug Nadvornik.